yesterday's London Times. Jen, we're recording a little maybe later in the day than we normally would.
We are, but it's so worth it.
You want to share what we've been up to tonight?
We were at the pagan festival for Krampus.
So our town, okay, our town. I never have asked you, did you watch the Gilmore Girls? Were you a Gilmore Girl?
I did. I was kind of at the prime age for that when that was out. Yeah.
So I think our town is as close to Stars Hollow as I've ever seen a town.
Yeah, I could see that.
Quirky people doing quirky stuff.
It's a little more diverse. But
it is more diverse.
Our town is more diverse.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we were involved in a pagan festival with thousands and thousands and thousands of people lining mm-hmm. the streets, and fire eaters and guys in whatever. They looked like they stepped right out of Where the Wild Things Are, and St. Nicholas was there. And
the Krampus was rampaging.
It's Krampus night. Oh my gosh, yeah, the Krampus and the hula hooping angels. Yeah. And it's too much. It's great.
I think it's one of the biggest Krampus festivals in the world, definitely in North America.
Yeah. So that we've been out at that. We have just poured ourselves a nice hot buttered rum tonight.
Talk to me about this sorcery in a cup, because it's in a mug, I should say. It is warm and delicious.
It's you know what? I mean, if you've been out in the cold mm-hmm. and this slides down your throat. So, and I'll put the recipe on our site. We just are drinking some dark rum. Mm-hmm. I'm using, trying to think of the Kraken brand.
Yes.
And then we make a batter. Now, some people don't make a batter, but most of the recipes I saw, you've got some butter, good butter. You've got a little brown sugar. You've got all the kinds of spices that would go on a pumpkin pie. You've got mm-hmm. cinnamon, allspice.
Yes, it tastes like cloves a little bit.
Yeah, there's some clove mm-hmm. in there. And then you just put a couple of ounces of the rum. You put a heaping tablespoon of the batter, and you fill the rest with hot boiling water. Mm-hmm. And that is the magic that we're experiencing right now. So I was thinking about Christmas drinks, and I never have done mulled stuff. I mean, I guess I do mm-hmm. Russian tea, which is mm-hmm. somewhat mulled, but mulled wine, I've never mm-hmm. done that. I think, have you done that?
I'm a big fan of anything mulled. Those kinds of smells, tastes, everything. That's just kind of my thing. I like things that are heavy on cloves and those kind of flavors. So
yeah, I wonder what that is. Like in summer, we like the light fruity, but in mm-hmm. Winter, you kind of want something that maybe has simmered for a while, right?
Yeah, I mean, I even in the summer will turn towards those kinds of flavors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a winter body at heart.
There you go. So this is one of our Christmas episodes. Welcome.
It is. Welcome.
I've been enjoying the photos I've been seeing out of London right now with all the light displays.
Yes.
My gosh, Leadenhall Market is so gorgeous. Cartier mm-hmm. looks like a big package. There's that Chanel door that looks like a Chanel bottle. Annabelle's looks like a big, beautiful gingerbread house. Fortnum & Mason.
Darling.
I know, and it's fantastic. We'll put some of those on our socials too. Mm-hmm. Watch for those to appear in the month of December. And so this is our first time ever doing a Christmas episode. Isn't that exciting?
It is. I've been excited about this for a while.
Yeah. So I was thinking, you know, the first thought that came to mind, I have a few thoughts, but one was Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about a few things right away. I was wondering, like, was Scrooge modeled after somebody in particular? Mm-hmm. And I've read it many times and certainly watched the movies, but I couldn't remember if he actually name-checked locations. I always felt like he was probably in the financial district, but where else? Mm-hmm. And so I also wondered about, sometimes you see, maybe you've seen articles or even books written about, like, how Dickens invented Christmas. And I'm like, well, one of my curiosities is, like, well, what was Christmas like before and after mm-hmm. then? So those are a few questions that I had in mind coming into this. And so I'm thinking, okay, I'll read a little biography of Dickens, and I'll read some books about, you know, A Christmas Carol, a commentary. But Jen, I'm here to tell you that since that time, since I've read those two things, they have sent me off on shoots that include, I have a little list here, of course, the history of Christmas, Druidism, the Industrial Revolution, Victoria and Albert, workhouses, prisons, social classes and injustice, the banking industry, the publishing industry, poultry, parliamentary politics, 19th century sanitation, Malthusian economics, and London geography. We're going to wrap it up in a nice little bow and say Merry Christmas at the end of this.
I mean, you had me at Druidism. I mean,
you know what? Let's just talk about Druidism.
That was all I needed. That's phenomenal.
Nobody understands the rabbit hole more than you. I know you've done it many times, yes. But I just thought it would be fun to share, like, kind of how these podcasts evolve sometimes, where we think we're going to do one thing.
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
Mm-hmm. So tonight we're going to look at A Christmas Carol. We're going to find out how it came about, what it might tell us about London life and culture at the time, and of course its continuing influence.
Well, I'm excited to hear a new take on a story that I would say a very large majority of people are familiar with the premise of.
That's really a good point, because, like, am I going to find something? Am I going to scratch a surface? And yeah, buried deep, I found a very interesting and compelling narrative, so I hope you enjoy.
Well, you know, sometimes it's one of those things when something is so familiar, and it is one of those things. If you say Scrooge, I mean, even little kids are familiar with that. But yet it gets lost of what the actual meaning was, because it is so well known that people don't even know anymore. Does that make sense?
Sometimes we can keep it right on the surface,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. It kind of takes on a whole different meaning or evolves into something else.
Right. So the book is published in fall of 1843, December of 1843. And it's written in what is called five staves rather than chapters. Mm-hmm. Staves is a musical term, almost like a stanza or a verse. So get it, A Christmas Carol. I've never seen why he did that, but I assume that it's like this whole thing is a Christmas Carol.
Makes
and
sense.
So they're stanzas. So I've kind of divided our approach tonight into five staves or ideas.
Okay.
So ready to set off on stave one?
I'm jumping in.
All right. We're going to look at a brief history of British Christmas just to give us some context.
I'm ready.
So if I was to say to you, Christmas in Britain, Jen, like what picture might come to your mind?
Mm. Well, I immediately think of crackers and crowns.
Yeah. And yes, that's silly hats. Right?
Yes. My family enjoys crackers and crowns. So I think of sweets like mince pies,
yes,
trifles, those kinds of things.
Right.
I have loved, it hasn't happened for a few years, but the Doctor Who Christmas special. And
Christmas specials and the Queen's speech,
yes,
maybe. Yeah.
When I get the song, Merry Christmas, Everybody, by... I'm assuming it's called Slade. It's like some glam rock band from the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Yeah. Is that how, it's not Slade or something? Is that
right, I think it's Slade.
Okay, I thought it was just Slade. But Slade. So I don't know why. I think it's because it came up in Doctor Who Christmas specials. And it just seems like that song comes up on British Christmas specials all the time. So I sort of associate it with that.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me, Radio Garden. It's an app. We don't have any money in Radio Garden. But shout out to Radio Garden, which is... radio stations from around the world. Mm-hmm. And if you look up London Christmas, there's a 24/7, 365 days a year London Christmas station. Oh. So if anyone's wanting a little London Christmas and with the accents and everything, get on over there.
Internet, I love
after
you.
This episode.
Yes.
You know, another image that I sometimes think about is like the guys in top hats and mufflers singing God Rest You Merry Gentle, you know, and the little waifs nearby and looking in the windows and that kind of thing. So those are all images. We know, many of us, that this is a sacred Christian holiday, but it incorporates British culture and history. Mm-hmm. So the winter solstice being so near to Christmas and this whole Druid connection, that's what a lot of people know about that. But I didn't necessarily know, like, how did the Druids celebrate solstice? And one thing they did is they gave small gifts. And another is that they decorated their place, their homes or you know, wherever they were, with greenery. And all of it was symbolic, and it's the same things that we're using today, like holly and ivy and mistletoe and Yule logs, and all of it had very sacred meaning to that coldest, darkest time of the year. In the 1500s, the Reformation comes along, And the Puritans, you know, they're just so upset at this.
Oh, Puritans.
Oh, Puritans, please. This popish holiday and this pagan holiday because of the, you know, greenery and whatever. Now, I'm going to give, I never thought I'd be sticking up for Puritans.
No.
But truly, it had kind of gotten out of control, Christmas had, because I saw this program Lucy Worsley did on a Tudor Christmas. I mean, Jen, they were hardcore partying for like 12 days. Like, nobody worked. There's a thing like about all the excesses of King Henry VIII's court. And they,
the problem is?
Just curious. I don't know. Right. Well, the Puritans had a little problem with it.
They're it like, was their own war on Christmas.
Exactly. You know, this whole bacchanalian thing. So in 1649, they gained political control, Cromwell, mm-hmm. you know, and they abolished Christmas.
Wow.
They banned singing Christmas carols. It's sinful. Clergy could be jailed for celebrating the feast. Like, thank you, Cromwell and friends, for biggest party poopers. Buzzkill.
No kidding.
And so, but you know, power doesn't last long. 11 years later, they're out, 1660, and Christmas comes back, but never to the degree of that hardcore bacchanal.
Let's just take a moment to
I'm so sorry.
To mourn.
Let's mourn. Let's mourn this 12 day. Oh, we didn't even mention Snowasis too.
Oh,
the Snowasis this year of 3 days locked in a, or you know, snowed in a pub in Yorkshire. If yes. anyone has been following that in the news, they maybe had a 3 day version of it.
It might have been a Bacchavelli in 3 days right. up in the Snowasis.
Yeah. So that was 1660, and we're just going to let Christmas simmer there for okay. a while. It's just families are celebrating Christmas. Fine. Industrial Revolution comes mm-hmm. along, and families are changing. People are moving away from their families for opportunities. People are working way more, long, long 6 day work weeks.
Was there an increase of women working as well?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So, you know, what are we going to do with Christmas? Also, in 1837, Victoria takes the throne. Mm-hmm. And she marries Albert, of course, in 1840. He brings spruce trees to Windsor to celebrate in the German way. Now, a lot of historians have said, you know, they introduced the Christmas tree. Not true. Queen Charlotte, you historians know this. You were ready to get me, weren't you? Queen Charlotte, 40 years earlier, had brought greenery into the palaces or fir trees, evergreen trees.
But it was a German thing, right?
It was a German thing. It just wasn't reported on until Victoria and Albert. And I think that's like the press today. They love a young mm-hmm. family of royals, you mm-hmm. know? And so they were really watching everything about them, including the way that they celebrated the holidays. And so I was thinking about this time in history. And I was thinking a lot about the gin episode that you mm-hmm. did and how this industrial, how do we find meaning in an industrialized world? And mm-hmm. you painted a very bleak picture often mm-hmm. of those times. So in a time of this change and certainty, it seemed to me like they were probably ready for some nostalgia, for some kindness and goodness and tradition. And so I would probably argue that Dickens did not invent the modern Christmas. I think that he captured like a zeitgeist. He captured a spirit mm-hmm. of the time. He was in the right place at the right time mm-hmm. to write what he wrote. So that gives us a little background. Now, I just mentioned Dickens, so let's have stave two where we meet this
yes.
Charles. Now, if you read a biography, like say an encyclopedia entry or a Wikipedia entry, have you ever noticed that it'll say like childhood, and then it goes straight to kind of adulthood. They seldom talk about the teenage years. Mm-hmm. And I really don't want to talk much about my teenage years mm-hmm. either. And it's true of Charles, too. The encyclopedia will say, you know, he, as a young child, his father, riddled in debt, went to debtor's prison, leaving Charles to pretty much fend for himself. And he's working in a factory at age 12. And he published the Pickwick Papers at age 26. You're like, okay, that was the first place in my mm-hmm. research. I'm like, put on the brakes because yeah. how does this kid working at a factory become this like erudite man about town who's mm-hmm. so in tune with the human condition and so on. So I wanted to dig into that a little mm-hmm. bit.
Yeah.
So let's meet Charles and family. Charles is second of eight Dickens children.
Okay.
He's particularly close to two siblings. His older sister, Franny, so they're number one and two in line, and his younger brother, Fred. Those are his two close ones in the big family. His father works for the Navy in the pay office. And John Dickens is, I guess some people would call him the life of the party. I don't think his kids would necessarily call him that. He's the life of the party. He's over the top. He puts on these genteel airs, you know, using really mm-hmm. big vocabulary and, like, you know, always putting on airs. And but a really very popular guy, too. I think everyone liked to be around him, and then they didn't have to go home with him, you know.
So good in small doses.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And he also had an absolute lack of any kind of financial judgment. Mm. So he didn't have vices that put him in debt. He didn't, you know, gamble. He didn't have mistresses that we know of that he was paying off. He just continually spent more than he made, and it snowballed.
Now, you had said that Charles went to the factories at 12.
Yeah.
Was that to help pay for?
Oh, we're going to get there.
Okay. I was curious if that was typical that he did or if he had to because of the situation.
Yeah, we're going to work our way around to that. And Charles's mother, Elizabeth, she's very like her husband. Oddly enough, they don't have that yin-yang mm-hmm. thing that many couples do. She's very energetic, too. And she is frustratingly optimistic, like it's all going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And I read The Micawbers from David Copperfield, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, something's going to turn up. Don't you mm-hmm. worry. And they're like heading out the window because, you know, the rent is due or whatever.
Well, I get the feeling if they lived in modern times that they'd be up to their eyeballs in credit card debt.
That's it. Kind that's of thing. Them. That is them. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we're going to find that it seems to me that just about everyone that crosses Charles's path, he's going to write them into a book someday. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Names that he... people he worked with. But the family moves around a bit, and that's not unusual for a Navy family, right? So he moves from Portsmouth to London to Chatham, mm-hmm. which is going to be where Charles is going to spend some formative years, his ages 4 to 10.
Okay.
Charles has the opportunity to go to school. Yay! Where, of course, he excels. He's identified as, I'm doing air quotes, a sickly boy, as they said. And so he's exempted from sports. And instead, he loves to explore the outdoors. He loves to take long hikes. He loves to go where the ships are coming in and watch them come and go. He loves to put on dramatic shows. That'll come back later in his life. He puts on musicals with his sister, Franny, who is or Fanny, I should say, who is an exceptionally talented musician. In fact, the father, John, takes both of those oldest kids to the pub with him, and they'll sing sea shanties or whatever, mm-hmm. and so they're performing. He also, of course, is a voracious reader, and he reads everything in his father's library multiple times. We're talking like Robinson Crusoe, Don Quixote, texts like that. Now, I said that they lived in Chatham for 6 years, mm-hmm. but I didn't say they lived in one house because they're still like constantly moving from mm-hmm. one house to another as their fortunes rise and fall. So if they have a little extra, they start being really extravagant, having big parties, and then the money's gone and they find a little room somewhere. And so they're just constantly shifting around. In 1822, when Charles is 10 years old, John gets transferred to London. They move to a pretty rough street in Camden. Mm-hmm. And this is Charles's, 10-year-old Charles's first inkling that there's something wrong in the family. There's this financial problem. He can't go to school anymore. They just don't have the money for that. And this distresses Charles, you can well imagine. Mm-hmm. He misses his hometown so much, or what he considers his hometown of Chatham. He misses school. He misses nature. his sister, the talented musician, they do send her to school because she gets accepted to the Royal Academy of Music. She's a vocalist and piano. And so she gets the opportunity. Charles, 10-year-old Charles, is on the streets of London.
Wow.
And he, like many people would be during that time, it's kind of half repulsion of what he sees, like the gin craze episode, and half like intrigue or fascination too, because there's so much entertainment and all this stuff.
Sure.
So they're there just kind of making do for a couple of years until financial destruction finally sends Father John to debtor's prison at Marshalsea, which is in Southwark, south of the Thames. Now, have you ever heard about this thing where back in the day, a whole family might go to jail?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that happened here.
Wow.
They have 8 children, remember? And it's very interesting that the family can come with the prisoner, but it turns out to be an absolute extortion racket. Mm-hmm. Like the jailers are collecting money for everything. You have to buy every bed. You have to buy every cooking pot. You know, you can, the people who aren't in prison can come and go. Like they can go have a job maybe and come back. But every kind of perk you might want, a visitor, it's all money for the jailers. But the Dickens do take their 6 youngest children. Fanny's going to stay in music school. And our Charles, well, he's going to stay with kind of a distant family friend, an elderly woman in Camden, and she is near destitute herself. And this is when he takes on a job.
Is that why he didn't go to the... I'm curious why
he... I don't know either. I think that they thought, we need some income for the family.
And so you're next because your sister's in school. So.
Yeah, she's going to go to school. We found a place for you to stay, but you're going to have to help the family out. You're going to have to go into this factory.
Makes you wonder. There must have been so many emotions, but it's, you know, your choices are live with an elderly woman who's a friend of the family and work, or go live at jail.
Right. All right. Rocking a hard place.
Yeah. Really bleak.
And you think, let's just take a step back from this text now for a minute and think about Ebenezer Scrooge and how he's like, these people, they spend their money, you know, the way they spend their money. This is coming from a very deep-seated place in Charles's soul.
Yeah.
Like, the whole idea of just spending money too freely is just repulsive, you know.
It kind of takes a little bit of the villainry out of Scrooge in some ways.
In some ways, everybody has a story, right? So Charles is going to work in a place called Warren's Blacking Factory. The broad stroke is, we can call it like a shoe polish factory. It's like to make boots black. And so he's like little pots of polish he's dealing with. 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, young 12-year-old Charles. Now, not only is he working those long hours, and on his only day off Sunday, he's walking 4 miles from Camden downtown to Southwark to see his whole family. But he's also this learned little boy, this intellectual little boy. How do you think that plays with the other street urchins in the factory? Mm-hmm. Like, he gets the beat down bad.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they just, you know, crush him into the ground.
Yeah.
And this is not any, like, you can imagine, it's a typical Victorian factory with, like, the broken boards that you're walking on, rat infested. It's a terrible place.
Well, I'd imagine there must have been, even though, you know, he's working with other people who are likely pretty destitute, I would imagine that maybe there was a stigma with having your family actually in jail.
Right.
That way.
Exactly.
You know, my guess is maybe that would even be a step below what a lot of them on the social scale would have been dealing with.
Right, that they might have families at home that they're helping support.
Sure.
But, and he also, one of his coworkers is named Fagin, and there's another, I think, that is Bill Sykes. So he's finding all these names that he's going to later put into books. In time, the family is released. I think they get a small inheritance that helps them to you know, stabilize, and they're going to move back to Camden. And Charles is ready to, like, go back to school, and his mother says, no, I think you should keep working. And Charles told his biographer late in life that he never forgave her for that. Mm-hmm. He's like, I have done everything for this family. They're mean to me. There's rats. It's the worst conditions. And the rest of the family's going to stay at home. And I'm going to go stay where he was. So Charles's father overrides mom. So John mm-hmm. overrides Elizabeth and says, no, we're putting him back in school. Mm-hmm. He has a brain.
Yeah, I would think, too, you know, they saw the potential in the sister and let her go to music school. He had to be feeling.
Right. Right. And we know he's talented because he can put on shows. Yeah. He can use words very well. So he goes back at least for another 3 years until his family runs out of money again. But this time, school is not like it was in Chatham. No, it's not that idyllic romping through nature.
He's not at Eton, I'm assuming, either.
No, he's more like, if you've ever read or seen a version of Nicholas Nickleby, that the Squeers school. I mean, it's got the sadistic, ignorant headmaster. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible thing. But he does at least get exposed to a few more texts, that kind of thing. Anyway, a real scarred psyche from this trauma. It really is an early trauma of those 3 or 4 years mm-hmm. there with his family being upset and having to work and then going to this awful school. And it is a time that later will really just profoundly mark his social conscience too. Mm-hmm. So it's this deep personal hurt, but he's looking at society too. And he's really lived this experience mm-hmm. that he's later going to write about. So after that 3 years when the money runs out, now he's 15 and now he really can get a job. And he goes and works as a solicitor's clerk, like in a law office. Mm-hmm. The job is meh, but it's going to provide a lot of fodder for his later work, legal works that like Bleak House or Great Expectations.
As soon as you said where he was, you could see that seed being planted.
Yep. And this is the time when he really becomes a Londoner. Mm-hmm. He experiences everything that the city has to offer. A co-worker, his name was George Lear, recalled, quote, I thought I knew something of the town, but after a little talk with Dickens, I found I knew nothing. He knew it all, from Bow to Brentford. And this is likely the time when Charles developed a habit he would take for the rest of his life. And this is long distance, daily walking. He called it his daily constitutional. Minimum 12 miles. Wow. 12, 15, 20, as many as 30 miles in a day. He would just like, or a night. He would walk all night some nights. So he went there when he was 15. He comes out from that. He does a pivot in his career when he's 26. So he spent 11 years doing this. So he's like polishing up his skills, mm-hmm. his contacts. At 26, he pivots from law to journalism. Mm-hmm. Perfect, right? You know, he's got the skills. He's a childhood storyteller. He's been meeting people all over town. He knows the town.
He sees a lot.
He sees everything. So I think we're going to leave Charles now. Now that we've got the history of Christmas and we've met young Charles, we're going to leave him. He's going to start working his trade. He's going to fall in love a few times. And I think we should like pan out now.
Okay.
And look at Victorian London.
Yes.
So we're heading, all of this happens in fall of 1843. So mm-hmm. let's just talk a little bit about London, early mid 19th century. It is the largest city in the world. It's the most populated city in the world. Can you believe 2 million people?
Wow.
That's crazy, right?
That is.
It's the center of finance. It's the center of trade, the center of banking, all of that. It's the world's largest port, which is crazy because mm-hmm. it's not even a coast. You know, it was the Industrial Revolution now is in full tilt, and London is both getting all the benefits from that and paying the price for it, as you well know. Much of London is a slum. There's the gin episode, poverty, we know can lead to hopelessness and despair.
Lots of it.
Did you, in researching the gin episode, did you run across a guy named Henry Mayhew, a journalist?
Yes, the name popped up a few times.
He wrote a really important book, and I'm going to link to it because you can read the whole thing online now. It's called London Labor and the London Poor, and it's 4 volumes. And the most wonderful thing is that he lets the poor speak for themselves. It's just transcripts of talking to chimney sweeps, prostitutes, rag pickers, street musicians, you know, mud
sort
larks.
Of like the Humans series of today, like Humans of New York and Humans of the World.
Or earlier there was a thing by Studs Terkel called Working, was just interviews with people. And so there's four volumes of this. And, you know, that's a big thing in, especially in education of, you know, oh, everybody, primary sources. And then we have to step back and go, wait, think about primary sources. Like, who could read and write? Mm-hmm. Who could buy paper? Mm-hmm. Who could publish it in such a way that someone would have it today or send them mail or whatever it is? So this, the idea that Mayhew, we have to trust. There's never been in any of my research did I see any question that he didn't just report word for word what people had to say. So it helps us. It gives us this little valuable window and kind of lets us time travel a little bit. But Jen, if we were really good at time travel, do you remember our book club this week? How we were talking about Shakespeare's day. Like our senses probably couldn't even stand it.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of had to laugh because I knew I was going to talk about it today, Dickens time. I want you to think about if we were to be pulled back there. Okay, feces right there. There's tens of thousands of horses in the city. 2 million people. So there's human and animal urine, feces. There's cesspools, rotting meat and vegetable, all fish, vegetation. There, and aside from like Shakespeare's days, there's factory smoke and charcoal soot, body odor, decomposing,
leather and tanning,
right? Refuse, gaslighting. There's river sewage. You know, there's all that. Of course, some of those things I mentioned also bring cholera, malaria, we're dealing with smallpox, consumption, syphilis, all of that. So now, I was going to end on that note. Like, that's not very cool, but we have some history. We have a person we're going to follow. We have the place we're going to follow him to. And I think that maybe we should take a little break and then we should come back and get a classic book written, right?
Yes, I think that sounds great. I mean, we might as well end on that note, right?
All right. Good luck. Go get yourself a nice something to drink, everybody. We'll be right back.
Thanks. We're back. It's been great, but I'm ready for you to take me out of the Victorian stench that you left me in.
You know, let's move uptown, right?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's get back with Charles.
Yeah.
Because we last saw him as a 26-year-old who was pivoting into a new career. That man hits the ground running. Remember, we're leading toward 1834, the fall of 1834. Mm-hmm. By then, he'll be 31 years old. He'll be married to Catherine. In 6.5 years of marriage, they will have 4 children.
Oh, my goodness.
All surviving. And so in these last 6 years since we've last seen Charles, he has experienced success as a journalist. Maybe you've heard of Sketches by Boz was his beat. He's the author of the Pickwick Papers and Oliver Twist already and Nicholas Nickleby already and the Old Curiosity Shop. And you may know that these books are coming out in monthly installments.
Yes.
So that last one, the Old Curiosity Shop, caused him a bit of grief because people were waiting and waiting and waiting for each installment. And maybe you've heard of Little Nell. I've never read the Old Curiosity Shop, but it has a character named Little Nell.
I have heard of Little Nell.
Yeah, she's this angelic wayfish orphan. And will Little Nell survive? And Dickens kills her off. And let's just say you know, a lot of people wanted to kill him off after that. You know, I picture people coming up to him on the street like, that one's for Little Nell, you know, yeah, whack.
You don't whack Little Nell.
Yeah, right.
Not okay.
That's followed by Barnaby Rudge, which has disappointing sales. And then comes Martin Chuzzlewit, another one I've never read.
Yeah,
this is 1842, so this is the year before the year that we're heading to. Charles thinks that Martin Chuzzlewit is his finest work to date. He is so excited to release this child of his out into the world, mm-hmm. and it just sits there. Sales are just very, very poor, and the sales are so dreadful, in fact, that his publisher actually docks much of his pay. So now this creates a financial burden for him, as well as this whole, you know, like, people don't like my work, and I thought it was mm-hmm. so good.
But there's a real risk in being a writer.
Yes.
So if you don't have success, it might not even be that you don't, it's not just that you won't make money, you're going to owe money.
Right, right.
To your publishing lords.
Yeah, that's you've got four babies at home.
And he probably had nightmares of growing up and, you know.
All of it.
Becoming destitute. I mean, all it was probably
it.
Very
it's
dire.
All part of it. Yeah. So that's 1842. 1843, he has a few other experiences. He goes to one of the ragged schools on behalf of his dear friend and ours, Angela Burdett Coutts.
Oh,
she
Angela.
Asks him, she didn't want to do it herself. She wants him to go and check back with her. And this is a very streetwise guy. You know, he's walked all over the city, and his time, his visit to the ragged school was absolutely harrowing. He quote, I have seldom seen in all the strange and dreadful things I've seen in London and elsewhere, anything so shocking and as the dire neglect of soul and body exhibited in these children. So Charles, his politics, he's not a Marxist, although Marx is publishing at this point. He doesn't believe in upending social norms, you know, mm-hmm. not social upheaval. But he does believe that everyone should have the opportunity to better themselves. That's improvement is a big thing with Charles. So he reports back to Angela, and they're going to work together, and they will work on many successful charities. By the time we meet up with Charles in mid-1843, let's bring it all the way to fall 1843.
Okay.
To say the very least, he's in an absolute total funk. Let me run it through. So he's got the writer's block. Mm-hmm. If people have rejected the work that he thought was his best, then what does he do next? He has also kind of lost that prestige of being the new guy in town, the boy wonder kind of mm-hmm. thing. The previous year, 1842, he had gone on his first speaking tour of the United States. And that left him disappointed. He was really excited to see this land of freedom and opportunity. And when he gets there, he says, it's, quote, not the republic of my imagination, mm-hmm. because of the industrialization and the greed and the plantations and slaves and the quick buck and the huckster. He sees it all like that. He gets back to England. He starts attending benefits, and he's trying to help. He's trying to figure out where he can help socially. But he comes away from each of these benefits, like kind of rubbing elbows with the wealthy. You know, he just comes away angrier and angrier. Great quote. He describes these wealthy men as, quote, sleek, slobbering, bow-paunched, overfed, apoplectic, snorting cattle. Like, Charles, what do you really think, honey?
Can I write that down to use it later? That's right. Perfect.
It is. He is a man who really, he has this conscience. He wants to do something so very much. He wants to, as he says, strike a sledgehammer blow. Like, I want to wake people up, but he can't figure out how. He's thinking, he's seriously thinking about publishing some sort of pamphlet, like about the needs of the poor, but he can't, he's just circling around it, trying to find what it'd be. As you mentioned, he's in debt up to his eyeballs now. He's living even beyond his means, and this is the trigger for him. Like, uh-oh, living beyond, like all of that starts mm-hmm. rolling out. Just the dread.
It's interesting with all that you described there, that he's experiencing such a writer's block. Like, even with, you know, do I write a pamphlet? As I'm thinking back to researching the gin episode, which would have been a little bit earlier than this, but you're thinking of all the people who were writing pamphlets about how to solve these societal issues who really were looking from a top, from their perch down, right?
Yes.
But Dickens had lived it. Yeah, I mean, his parents were in a jail. He had been in, you know, given his experience, it's interesting that he just didn't write about his experience.
Well, interesting, even more interesting is that he never tells anyone about his secret. It's a secret.
Wow.
So he eventually tells his wife, and years later, when he's an old man, he tells his biographer. His kids learn about it by reading his biography.
That is fascinating.
He keeps it all a secret. It doesn't fit with the rest of his image of man about town and this, you know, loquacious, you know.
Such a contradiction to his desire to want to solve the problems. You'd think the solution's right there in front of him.
Maybe shame, you know. Yeah. I don't know.
It's fascinating.
It really is. Complex person. His family. His parents are just relentlessly still in debt. Like, he has a family of his own to worry about. He's still, like, buying them a house, and they'll still call for money. He's constantly bailing them out. His father begins, you know, remember, this is this over-the-top guy. He starts, like, trading in on Charles's name all over town.
Of
like,
course
I'm
he does.
Charles's father, give me a perk, or put it on Charles's tab. He even, like, writes letters to Charles's solicitor and even his publishers. Can I get an advance? It's so embarrassing.
Gross.
And even worse is that he goes through Charles's trash and takes out the drafts.
Ah.
And at this point, everybody's trying. I mean, as soon as Charles writes a book, someone, like, he'll write Nicholas Nickleby and someone else will write, like, Nicholas Knuckleby, and it'll be kind of similar. But his father's trading off of this. Just terrible. And
any word on where his siblings are?
Well, Fred is his two that he's very close to. Fanny has moved up to Manchester, wife, but the music is kind of not really happening. It's in the background. His dear brother Fred had been his roommate. Even he took him into his home before he was married and while he was married. So when he went to America, like, Fred took care of the kids. But he sees right now Fred falling into his father's footsteps. Can you give me this money? Can you? He's finding jobs for him that don't work out, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the family that he created. So there's the family he was born into, the family he created. Catherine, right now, fall of 1843, finds out she's pregnant with number 5. Mm-hmm. And the marriage is under stress. By all accounts I read, Charles loves his children, but he's really... He even starts having, like, nightmares about this fifth one, like, you know, really terrible nightmares. His wife, Catherine, I mean, I'm trying to be really fair in history, but everything I read said the most terrible thing was that maybe she had done, like, been going through some postpartum kind of thing. She seems fairly oblivious to her kids. She's not as engaging. He's the one, like, crawling around on all fours and making mm-hmm. up stories with them. And she's kind of taking maybe care of the newest baby, but also redecorating the house and that kind of thing. So she doesn't really connect with her children as much. Sidebar, I don't want this to be the focus of a Christmas story, but I wouldn't feel right not sharing that this marriage is going to end up badly in about a dozen years from the time mm-hmm. that we're talking. It's a long story, probably an episode of itself, but Charles treats her just abominably. He behaves. He just is all over town with women and gaslighting her.
I had heard that.
Yeah. I don't really want to go into it because I couldn't give it what it's due. There's a TV show, if you ever get a chance to see it, put out by the BBC with Sue Perkins, called Mrs. Dickens' Family Christmas, that puts a lot of it into perspective. Oh. I got a chance to watch that. Anyway, there's all these pressures. There's the writer's block, the money, the family pressures. He knows he needs to write something quickly. He's thinking, maybe I can do some sort of Christmas story. That'll earn me some fast cash, and I need it. This brings us to October of that year. Charles gets invited to speak in Manchester at the Manchester Athenaeum. And he loves the Athenaeum's goal, which is providing educational opportunity for laboring men and women. And he doesn't want to go because he's having pictures of those snorting cattle, you know, that we talked about. But his sister Fanny lives in Manchester, and she asks him as a personal favor, like, please, this is some place that I give a lot of my support to, this Athenaeum, and you can spend some time with me. And he's like, oh, you know, getting out of town for a little breath of fresh air, getting to spend some time with my sister and her family, that might be a good thing. Fanny, incidentally, has two sons that Charles will spend a lot of time with because he's going to stay in the house with her rather than in the hotel that the other speakers will be in. And her oldest son, Henry, is handicapped, but this very special child who is said to be like beyond his years and very meditative quality about him. Mm-hmm. We may revisit him in a little bit later in the episode. So it's with the weight of the world on his shoulders, really, that he boards a train for Manchester. Along the way, he's going to have some interesting conversations. It's a pretty long train journey, especially in that day from London to Manchester. The other two people on the bill, so Charles is the headliner. Benjamin Disraeli will be speaking. He's a current member of Parliament, will go on, of course, to become Prime Minister. And a self-described radical liberal politician named Richard Cobden. And so they're having conversations up on the train, this 200-mile journey. And when he gets to Manchester, he visits with his sister. He continues that daily walk. He walks all over Manchester. And wow, the sources I read really pointed. They're kind of like, if you thought London was bad, Manchester was horrible during this time because it didn't have really the arts or the balance. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like all the slum and all the poverty. So he just sees this unmitigated, just industrialism and hopelessness. His speech that he makes is very passionate. You can read it online. His theme is a little education is a dangerous thing. And it's reported on newspapers throughout England and even beyond. So it's with all of this that is weighing on his mind. He's thinking about, you know, his experiences up there, about poverty, about the need to write some sort of Christmas story. And similar to J.K. Rowling, when she says that Harry Potter came to her on a train and spilled out of her, same thing with him. On the train, he's thinking about this. All these elements are coming together. A picture is starting to form in his mind. It's October. Christmas is coming. And it takes a while to print books. So it pours out of him in what he calls a white heat in 6 short weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. It's got to be, don't you think? It's got to be just this cathartic. This is what he's been building up to. He tells friends that he writes in letters that he wept and laughed and wept again. And thinking whereof, he walked about the black streets of London, 15, 20 miles, many a night, when all the sober folks had gone to bed. So it's just this cathartic. He's laughing. He's crying. He's almost kind of breakdown in a way, you know. And this piece of literature is just pouring out of him. So the book gets published on the 19th of December.
Wow.
1843, a run of 6,000 copies. He gets really involved, and he actually owns a piece of it this time. He's very unhappy with his publishers. So he wants it to look good. So he takes personal risk and a loss because he wants a certain type of leather and paper and all this. 6,000 copies sell out immediately. Second and third editions are published within weeks.
Wow.
Within a month, the US release is happening. And this is just an instant classic. There's so much literature from the time about different people's reactions. I really liked one by G.K. Chesterton, the novelist G.K. Chesterton. He wrote, "The beauty and the real blessing of the story do not lie in the mechanical plot of it, the repentance of Scrooge, probable or improbable. They lie in the great furnace of real happiness that glows through Scrooge and everything around him. Whether the Christmas visions would or would not convert Scrooge, they convert us." So a friend of Charles Dickens, Lord Jeffrey, writes to him a short time after the publication. He says, "The tale has prompted more positive acts of beneficence than can be traced to all the pulpits and confessionals in Christendom since Christmas of 1842. So like in the last year, this book has done it. Jen, I wanted to take a look at a few of the connections that I wondered about originally, like some of the places and people that are mentioned in the novel. Yeah. Ebenezer, Scrooge. Mm-hmm. I looked on Wikipedia. Do you know that over 100 actors were cited on the Wikipedia page? I mean, we know that community theaters all over the world have done it. But as far as movies, you know, high-profile plays, TV series, that kind of thing, 100 are cited on Wikipedia, which is nuts. Charles Dickens, like many authors, kept notebooks of everything he ran into. He reminds me a lot of J.K. Rowling in this. He's always writing down little words, phrases, names. And so he was, well, he was going in her stomping ground of Edinburgh. He was in the Canongate Kirkyard, and he sees a tombstone name, and he jots it down, and it's Ebenezer Scroggy. So whether he maybe didn't write it right, or maybe this mixed up with something from his childhood, because there's a historian, a literary historian. What a great job is that?
Oh,
literary historian, Dr. Ruth Richardson. She's gone through like all of the places he lived and found all the historical data, businesses nearby, neighbors, and she's trying to put all these pieces together. So she uncovers a cheesemonger named Marley and a present, a premises of two tradesmen that work together, Googe and Marnie. So it's kind of like Scrooge and Marley, but Googe and Marnie. And so people at the time that it was released, they're like, oh, could Scrooge be this person? Like, who is Scrooge? Is he modeled after someone real? Could it be the contemporary economist, Thomas Malthus? Because Malthus, you know, a lot of what Scrooge says really is Malthusian. It's, you know, about like the system can't sustain itself. Like the poor are a problem, you know, rather than incorporating the, you know, looking at population supplies and unsustainability. People are thinking maybe it's Jemmy Wood, also known as the Gloucester Miser. Many people think that he's modeled after a man named John Elways. He's an eccentric miser from a family of misers. Jen, they're terrible. Guys, E-L-W-E-S, John Elways. What a crazy story. I could go on about him. His uncle, who was a miser, left him £250,000. You know, if you don't spend anything, that would be like $20 million now. Yet Elways, our John Elways, went around like in rags. There's a story about him finding a wig, like in a gutter, and like it's perfectly good wig, and wears it for weeks. People would put pennies in his hand when he walked around town because they thought he was a beggar.
Wow.
He was the guy who like went to sleep as soon as it got dark because you don't want to light a candle because you'd have to pay for candles then. He wouldn't see a doctor because there would be a doctor bill. He got angry at birds because they're stealing his wheat out there where his horses are in the carriage. Just nuts. They want to make a nest, John, okay?
I mean, it's almost like a disease.
It really is. And I want to show you a picture of him.
Oh, yeah.
There's Ebenezer. Ebenezer Scrooge right there.
There is a definite. I mean. And with the, you know, the long bony nose.
Exactly. And
the, yeah. Yeah.
He's got the, you know, protruding eyes, the, you know, yeah. Just looks just like every picture of Scrooge you've ever seen looks just like this guy. Other people just say, you know what? Scrooge is probably really just a part of Dickens' psyche, really. Just that part of him that's frustrated and disgusted with his spendthrift, you know, family. So Scrooge, we know that he must work in the heart of the city, the square mile, where the bankers and moneylenders have always been near the Bank of England there. I think I read something that all the banks had to be You had to be able, any bank in London had to be within 10 minutes walking distance from the Bank of England, mm-hmm. because they called all the shots. And if they had a big announcement to make, they would only need to wait a half an hour. Like everyone could be sent out to collect some money, 10 minute walk. Scrooge, in his goings on around town, name checks St. Paul's Cathedral, is mentioned. Mansion House is mentioned, where the Lord Mayor lives. You'll remember that Charles Dickens' two favorite siblings are his older sister, mm-hmm. Fanny, his younger brother, Fred. Well, Scrooge's sister is Fanny, and his nephew is Fred. Let's think about the Cratchits. The dear Cratchits. Oh my gosh, we haven't, this whole episode, we haven't talked about the Cratchits yet. They're awesome. Bob Cratchit, it's mentioned in the text, earns 15 shillings a week. Hey, guess what? That's to the penny the exact wages that Charles earned as a clerk for a solicitor.
Wow.
We know a lot about the Cratchits from the text. It's spelled out that they live in Camden Town. Mm-hmm. And historians will
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, right? The historians will say, we know exactly where they live because they lived at 16 Baham Street. Mm-hmm. That's where the Dickens lived. There were 8 Dickens living in a 4-room house. There are 8 Cratchits living in a 4-room house. God, paging Dr. Freud. You know, where they lived on Baham Street, I looked up the, you know, recent real estate. It's so hip there now. A 1-bedroom flat will set you back about $500,000.
Oh, yeah.
Or £500,000, I should say. And, of course, it wouldn't be an episode about Christmas Carol if I didn't mention Tiny Tim. Now, remember Franny's young son, Henry,
yes.
who is, quote, crippled. Many think that Tiny Tim is named after that meditative boy who had some physical disabilities. And there was a last minute change to the text in the publisher. The galley proofs do not say this line. Originally, the line was at the very end of the book about Scrooge. To Tiny Tim, he was a second father, is the original line. Dickens has written it in the galley proofs just before it went to print. To Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father, and not is in capitals. And everyone thinks that that's him talking to the people who blamed him for Little Nell. He's like, this time,
this character,
he did not die.
Yes.
So that's the book. And the Christmas of 1843 was a very festive one for Charles Dickens. And for many years after that, he really celebrated Christmas. Him and his kids would put on plays. I love this. It's just such a great line that he wrote to a friend. He said, this Christmas, such dancings, such conjurings, such blind man's bluffings, such theater goings, such kissings out of old ears and kissings in of new ones. Isn't that great?
That is great.
Sorry, my voice is giving up a little bit. For years, the family would do it up big. And in this book, Scrooge's nephew, Fred, really shares the social theme of the book. And we have to bring that into this yes. discussion. He says Christmas is, quote, a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut up hearts freely and to think of the people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe it has done me good and it will do me good. And I say, God bless it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Isn't that beautiful?
That is. It's beautiful.
It really is beautiful that we're all passengers on this journey, at least for a short time.
Yes.
And man, geez, Jen, this seasonal tour of our favorite city, it just, it's really been bringing back the year that we've been on, you know,
yes.
starting in January of
yeah.
this last year. We've had a very rough time of it with so many blessings and yes. so many challenges, you know, the best of times and the worst of times. And here yeah. we are, we're all back at Christmas again, but we're all in it together. And my personal wish is that, like Scrooge, we can come to understand that the suffering of other people with whom we share this world, you know, if we turn our backs to it, we're not only denying them the opportunity to grow and change and become, but we're doing the same thing to ourselves.
Yeah.
We're denying that in and of ourselves. And so I know it's corny, but I'm going to say it.
Do it.
Do God it. Bless us, everyone.
Oh, I love it. This was, you know, this, I appreciate, I the sentiments you just shared, I completely agree with. And, you know, I really appreciate you taking us on the tour. It's, you know, it's fascinating. This is a book. I mean, you become familiar with this story as yeah. a very young child.
Yes.
You know, and there's parts of it, you know, how many countless sitcoms and cartoons oh bring in the ghost of Christmas yes. past and future. I mean, it just, yes. you know, it's almost become a part of the public domain. I mean, you know, Don't Be a Scrooge. Is
yes.
A
yes. Bah saying, humbug. Yeah. Yes.
And even aside from Christmas, you know, if somebody, you can be in the middle of summer and someone is being stingy, you know, well, aren't you a Scrooge?
Right. Right.
Kind of thing. Yeah. You know, it's almost a verb and a noun and, you yeah. know, it's, but it's one of those things that it's so familiar and use so much that we become unfamiliar.
Right. I had no idea really of much of his life story, and especially the events leading up to that pivotal journey to Manchester, you know, yes. and how just the influences behind this seemingly, you know, somewhat lighthearted tale of Christmas, you know, that there's so much wrapped into it, both personal trauma and
it was societal. Obviously pretty cathartic,
yes.
as you said. And, you know, I think too, you know, you had said it's, I know it's corny, but, and I, you know, there is a tendency of us all to get, you know, a little bit that way yeah. this time of year.
Yeah.
But it's true. You know, we've come back to it so many times in so many episodes that, you know, how many people have we discovered, you know, it's that working for the collective good. We come back to it so much.
Again and again.
Again and again. And everyday heroes. And Dickens.
Making a choice, right? Just yeah,
making your choice. You know, and Dickens was obviously, there was parts of his life and the choices he made that were problematic, as you touched yes. on, like any of us. And it was a complicated time. And there was a lot of inequity. There still is a lot of inequity.
Yeah.
But your point of, you know, when others are suffering, we're all suffering, really. And yeah. you're missing out, you know, and the world is missing out on the gifts that people have that are, you know, if your basic needs aren't being met, yes. you can't flourish.
Yes.
And we're all missing out when that occurs.
That's right.
So I think.
So along with the partying, right?
Yep.
Let's keep that in mind.
Though bringing yeah. back those 12 days of Christmas.
Hey!
You know, yeah, taking yeah. that time off from work, they, you know, that was kind of a good gig.
12 days of Christmas, you can watch a lot of versions of A Christmas Carol. You know, my family mm-hmm. did that one year. A weird set of circumstances actually put us on the front page of a newspaper because we had this little chart. We were watching like Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol and, you know, the Flintstones Christmas Carol and every regular movie of it. And, you know, the Bill Murray, Scrooge, mm-hmm. and, you know, all the rest and rating them and writing out some, you know, but, it's going to be a time for partying. And this will be our final episode pre-Christmas, but I wonder if you want to share what's coming next from yes. the YLT pod.
Yes, I'm about due to bring something to the table here, and I think if you want to join me, I think we should have a Boxing Day episode.
Love it.
So we'll have to look at the calendar and see. I think it'd be fun to release it on Boxing Day. I think
yeah,
Boxing Day is
Sunday, right?
Is it a Sunday?
I think it's a Sunday. I think Christmas is a Saturday.
You're
Boxing
right.
Boxing Day is a Sunday. So
you're right. Yes.
Yeah, we'll
yes.
release it that weekend. Yes. Right.
So yeah, we'll release it. I guess when we typically do then, because it will work out right.
Great. But, great tradition, right? Is that yeah. shows in Britain release a Boxing Day episode? Absolutely. Or a Christmas episode. Yeah.
Well, and I've been saying for years, I think that Boxing Day should become a thing.
Why not?
You know, in the United States. Yeah, like, I don't know why that's a tradition that we let go of. I think it's brilliant.
I cannot wait to hear more about it. I know just the rough outline of it. So I can't wait to delve in and have some fun with it, too.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Boxing Day and then just kind of have a YLT celebration. We're just going to kind of look back at the previous year and maybe look forward to some things. You were speaking of rabbit holes, and I have definitely been going down some rabbit holes with some things that I cannot wait to share in the very cold months ahead.
Yes.
That's just a little clue.
Oh, we're working on things for you, my friends.
Oh, it's yes. I'm really excited about some things to come.
Yeah.
So I've been reading some amazing things and learning about some just fascinating people. And I can't wait to share.
Here comes 2022.
I can't wait.
Yeah. So friends, please visit us on the social medias. We're going to have some interactive things coming up in this month.
Yeah,
we wish you all a happy holiday. Yeah. Gosh.
And if you have a favorite episode of, you know, a favorite rendition, I should say, of A Christmas Carol, let us know. Let us know on Twitter, at YLT_pod. Maybe we should even put up a poll of some of the most common ones and sort of see what people like. But definitely on Facebook and Instagram, it's at Yesterday's London Times Podcast. Find us. Reach out and say hi. Tell us where you're listening from. If you have any ideas or any feedback or just want to chat about the latest episode, we'd love to bring you into the community that way.
Love it. And I don't know, but maybe if you're looking for anything to give to your favorite little podcast host here, you know, a nice little review if you've enjoyed what you've heard, we would really appreciate that.
That's a gift that would keep on giving.
Yeah. Thanks. We want to enlarge our circle.
That's
in
right.
The year. We want to find our crew.
That's right.
More people like you guys listening. So thank you so much.
Yes.
Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas. I'll see you on Boxing Day.
Absolutely. Good night.
Night. Thanks for listening and thinking along with us. We hope you enjoyed this segment of our journey.
Our music is from the album Astral Gate, used with permission of the artists Lucas Perny and Miroslav Kolar. Audio mixing by DJ Kensington.